I learned a lot. And also, as a colleague of John, I also wanted to say thank you very much to all of you who came to this conference, particularly those who came from far away. And I hope I can see many of you again in many different opportunities. Now,
should work. Oh, just a minute. Yes. And F5.
Oh no, I have. Yeah. So I'm from Japan, and I know bits of Japanese politics, and the topic that I was assigned was bicameralism in Japan. And then I got the schedule, I mean the program, and I noticed that the title of this session is Asian Innovations, India and Japan. But we don't have any innovation so far. as I will discuss, we need some innovation. We need to learn something from some other countries. And I added a subtitle, Searching for Innovation. I was planning to say this in the middle of my presentation, but maybe I can say this at the beginning. Just 2 months ago, a delegation from Japan's largest political party, Liberal Democratic Party, with four or three politicians, came to Canberra to learn what they can do, because the LDP is now facing the first ever situation in which they have a majority in the House, but the largest party in the upper house is not the Liberal Democratic Party. So, the leader of the delegation, the famous Japanese politicians, actually, here's an article, and I think I should read what he said. He said the Australian Parliament's own experience in similar situations, particularly following the 1975 constitutional crisis, had been instructive in providing insight into the conventions that allow government to operate with an upper house controlled by the opposition. So those LDP politicians came here and met senators and went back, and they are going to have the next lower house election quite soon, so you can see what lessons they learned from their visit 2 months ago. But anyway, so bicameralism in Japan, and I am a quantitatively oriented political scientist. I usually do lots of statistical analysis, but this presentation, I don't have any statistical results, but I still want to show some numbers first. The Japanese diet, the parliament, we say the diet, I don't know why, but in Japanese, kokkai, two houses. One is House of Representatives, a lower house, and House of Councillors. And 480 seats in the house, lower house, and 242 seats in the upper house, the smaller size in the upper house. But like Italy, the electoral systems used in two houses are so similar. It's basically a mix of plurality district-based systems and a proportional representation. There are some tiny, some people say not tiny, some differences. Like a lower house, we have 300 single-member district system, like the fast-past-post system, like the one used in the U.S. and the U.K. But in the upper house, about a half of these districts are single-member districts, but we still have a multi-member district system based on with a single SNTB voting rule. And at proportional representation, relatively smaller as compared to the number of seats elected from districts, but closed list for a lower house election and open list in the upper house election. times 4 years in the lower house, but typically dissolved within 3 and 3.5 years. The upper house, 6 years and fixed, which is actually very important difference between the US, Japan and Australia. Half elected every 3 years in July. The last election in the lower house, September 11, 2005. So 3 years have passed, and many people are saying that the next one will be very soon, maybe in the early November, or definitely before Christmas. The upper house, the last one was in July last year, so the next one 3 years later. So not much change in the composition of political parties and seats in the upper house for at least 3 more years. Now, I then planned to introduce some recent interesting political changes, but just in case you do not know much about Japanese politics, I need to give you a 10-minute introduction to Japanese politics, or maybe less than 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. We have the so-called 1955 system. Like Italy, we had the large political party dominated two houses for many years. That is the Liberal Democratic Party. And the Liberal Democratic Party was formed by merging two conservative parties in 1955. And the LDP had more than a majority of seats in both houses until 1989. And the second bullet point is not directly relevant to today's this conference, but there is an argument that under the SNTV system, those opposition parties, Japan Socialist Party, which also merged in 1955, and Communist Party and some small parties, they couldn't become a viable alternative to the LDP because of the incentives produced under the SNTV system. But anyway, so fragmented opposition and the LDP was so strong and dominated both houses until 1989. Then in the 1989, we had a lower upper house election. For the first time, the percentage of seats for the lower house went down, became lower than 50%, but still by forming a coalition with a small party, they could maintain a majority of seats in the upper house. But, by the way, after 1989, how many prime ministers? Well, nearly 20 years. Do you know how many prime ministers we had in the 20 years?
12.
15. So revolving doors. Yes, so many, and it's even difficult for me to say all of these 15 prime ministers in the past 20 years. But anyway, one of the explanations for that, why we have so many prime ministers, is because the LDP lost a majority of seats in the upper house. And then in the early 1990s, we had major political changes. In June 1993, a series of LDP defections, including a group led by the current opposition leader, Ichiro Ozawa. And then right after that, there was a lower house election, and for the first time since 1955, non-LDP coalition government was formed. But then under the non-LDP coalition government, lower house electoral reform bills passed, and then soon after that, even without election, LDP came back in power by forming a winning coalition with the Japan Socialist Party. And then from June 1994, what is called the 1994 system of Japanese politics started, which is basically the era of LDP-led coalitions. That's 1994. And then during this period of coalition politics, lots of interesting things happened. But in 2005, an interesting election, we had an interesting lower house election. At that time, the prime minister was Junichiro Koizumi. And his pet project was to privatize postal system. And his reform bill passed the lower house because LDP, together with coalition partners, had a majority of seats. Then sent it to the upper house, but there are some, not some, 10, 20 LDP upper house members who didn't support Koizumi's reform. So the bill was rejected in the upper house. Then what happened was the prime minister, Koizumi, surprisingly dissolved the lower house. The bill didn't pass the upper house, but because unlike the situation in Australia, a Japanese prime minister cannot choose double dissolution. So what he did was to dissolve the lower house and then send pro-reform new political candidates. And then Koizumi didn't endorse former LDP politicians, but those who didn't support postal reform. And at this single issue election in 2005, was quite successful for the LDP, and then LDP and the new Komeito, another the major coalition partner, still it's the coalition partner of LDP, got more than 2,000 seats in the lower house. But then Koizumi resigned, and Abe became the prime minister. I think that's Abe. And then a series of political scandals. And then Abe had to face a lower house election because, as I said, upper house election fixed. Okay, so the prime minister had to face the upper house election in 2007. No choice. July every 3 years. Okay, and then Abe was a bit unfortunate, very unfortunate. And then DPJ became the largest party in the upper house for the first time. So DPJ plus some small opposition parties now have more than a half of seats. So this is the first situation in the Japanese politics, and we called the twisted diet, or in Japanese, nejire kokkai. LDP and a new Komeito lower house, they have 70% of seats in the lower house. But in the upper house, the coalition has 43%. And the opposition, the largest opposition, DPJ, nearly has 50%, but they can easily form a winning coalition in the upper house because there are two or three small groups who are so close to DPJ's party platform. And there are, of course, some independents. Basically, the opposition coalition has a majority of seats in the upper house. So what happened is unprecedented deadlock. The ruling coalition in the lower house, LDP and new Komeito, struggles to pass legislation. Like many other countries here and many other, the India and other cases, because the opposition blocks it in the upper house. But this is the very, very first time for Japanese politicians to face this situation. So they still don't know what to do. The DPJ, the Democratic Party of Japan, the largest opposition party, they really want to gain power in the lower house. So they're so eager for new non-LDP government led by DPJ, so they have absolutely no interest in cooperating with the LDP coalition government. And the LDP, three prime ministers since Koizumi, just a minute, after Koizumi, Fukuda, Abe, Fukuda, and Kono. Yes, so I can name all of these three. But because of so much political difficulties, two prime ministers just all of a sudden gave up. I cannot do anymore. So please choose the next prime minister. So all of a sudden, as you perhaps heard from some news. So three prime ministers, and then the newest one, Taro Aso. Did I say Aso? Okay, Aso Taro. Sorry, Aso Taro. He must hold the next follow-up election within a year, but I think within 2-3 months. Now, go back to something. Well, not go back, but I want to move on to something more general, which can be your interest. Why Japanese? The upper house is so powerful. Actually, I need to say that until 1989, particularly until recently, many of the Japanese political scientists, like Italian political scientists, said that Japanese upper house is useless. They do nothing. But that was simply because LDP had often, particularly after 1989, with some small coalition partner, LDP had a majority of the seats in the upper house. But once they faced the current situation, non-LDP party coalition has a majority of seats, politicians and political scientists, journalists and the public now realize how powerful Japanese upper house is. Okay, so let me explain some institutional procedures. The budget must be approved, submitted by the cabinet first to the lower house. And if the lower house approves the budget, but the upper house does not approve it, then a joint committee of both houses is held. But if they fail to reach an agreement, or the upper house does not reach a decision within 30 days, then the lower house decision becomes final. So in this regard, the lower house is powerful. Okay? And what actually happened in the fiscal year 2008 budget was DPJ and opposition parties just completely ignored the LDP budget proposal for 30 days. Just ignored. They did nothing. And then 30 days passed, and then the budget became effective. But because of this delay, there are so many important tax reforms, tax changes could not take place. And lots of confusions and lots of news in March and April because of the strategy taken by the opposition coalition in the upper house. What about bills? This is even more problematic. The bills can be submitted by lower house or upper house, co-equal. Okay? They have equal power. If the lower house passes a bill, the upper house, and then upper house rejects it, or again does not reach a decision within 60 days. Basically, if the upper house just simply ignore the bill proposed by the majority coalition in the lower house, then lower house must take a vote again. Okay? If more than 2/3 of the lower house members approves it, the bill becomes law. If not, the bill is just the end. Okay? And what actually happened? Okay? Fortunately, the current ruling coalition in the lower house, LDP and the new Kometo, has 2/3 or more seats in the lower house. Okay, so they can do whatever they want to do. And there are lots of interesting stories and anecdotes and cases, but I just wanted to give you two stories. One, the fiscal year 2008 budget-related bills. The budget passed because after 30 days. Okay, but budget-related bills must be supported by the 2/3 of the lower house members. What actually happened was, again, the DPJ and opposition parties didn't discuss Of course, so they didn't vote for the budget-related bills proposed by the LDP coalition for 2 months. And then 2 months passed, and then using two-thirds of the seats in the lower house, the LDP coalition passed the budget-related bills. Okay. Another interesting one is anti-terrorism special measures law. Again, something similar happened, but in this case, DPJ DPJ coalition, I mean opposition coalition in the upper house, faced strong criticisms from the public. I mean through the public opinion on the media. So they, instead of waiting for 6 days, they just rejected. Okay. Then, LDP coalition used two-thirds of the seats to pass anti-terrorism special measures law. Okay. But because of this complication and politicking and political conflicts, the Japanese Self-Defense Force, Afghanistan, well, this is particularly for the deployment in Afghanistan, the Japanese Self-Defense Force had the law was actually to extend the period of dispatchment to Afghanistan, but because of these political conflicts, Japanese Self-Defense Force came back to Japan and then went again. What a waste! Anyway, so that happened. So the implication is the next lower house election is so critical. Okay, very soon, maybe in November, and if the LDP-led coalition fails to keep two-thirds of the seats, bills, including budget-related ones and also anti-terrorism-related important bills, will not be passed unless LDP and DPJ cooperate. But many people said this is so unlikely because DPJ wants to form a non-LDP government. Actually, right after the Koizumi, Fukuda became the prime minister, and under the table, behind the scene, Fukuda negotiated with the opposition leader, Ichiro Ozawa, to form a large coalition, LDP plus DPJ. But for some reasons, they failed. And then since then, DPJ is strongly against an idea to form a grand coalition with LDP. So the LDP-DPJ cooperation is so unlikely. So many people are now saying that a major political realignment may take place soon. Okay. But even with this major political realignment, the twisted diet, Nejire Kokkai, is likely to continue or will happen frequently under the two-party system. The sentence is I copied and pasted from a post to a mailing list by Associate Professor Michael Sees at UCLA, a good friend of mine. He is an expert of Japanese politics and also has written some journal articles on bicameralism. And he says this, parliamentarism is simply incompatible with strong bicameralism, where strong means that both houses are powerful and the chance of divided control is high. Okay. And but I know this is not just his argument. You know, Campbell, I think he said something similar, and I remember a few of us mentioned inconsistency or incompatibility of majoritarian two-party system and parliamentarism, particularly, but the two-party system and the bicameralism. And this is the difficult situation we are facing in Japan. But Mike thinks, and many other people think that these problems we are facing now are different in natures from divided government. Divided government in presidentialism. I mean, of course, U.S. Okay, divided government in parliamentarism with effectively powerless second chamber is also a different nature. Then I attended yesterday's session, and I thought Australia and Japan are similar. So it may be, I actually added this slide yesterday after the end of the first day one. And it may be interesting to do some comparative study Australia and Japan. And the reason why this LDP politicians came to Australia was their decision makes sense, because the divided control is common, not uncommon in Australia, and the Senate is so powerful. Okay? And Australia had a constitutional crisis in 1975, and in a sense, the situation, we still don't have a constitutional crisis, but it's a crisis for the LDP, and we will have a major political change, I assume, quite soon. So two countries have a powerful second chamber, but Australia has experienced Japan in the post-war Japanese history. But I then noticed that Australian senators tend to say, in my understanding, Australian Senate is so powerful, maybe the strongest in the world democracy, maybe. Some people say that. But the difference between Australia and Japan is that both houses can be dissolved, of course, by Governor General, but the Prime Minister can take an initiative. But in the case of Japan, the only lower house can be dissolved. So there seems to be some fundamental institutional failures in the Japanese in Japanese politics. That's what I learned by attending this conference. Thank you. But anyway, so the constitutional reform, we had some interesting discussions about constitutional reforms. So one solution, and I want to relate to the past discussions, one solution suggested by Michael Sis and also some other people is to do is a constitutional reform. Upper house in Japan should be weakened. Okay, for example, the prime minister can dissolve both houses, or when the bill is rejected in the upper house, the lower house needs only a half instead of the two-thirds of the members of to override the opposition, the rejection in the upper house. But this requires a constitutional reform, and Japanese constitution was drafted, of course, by the U.S. government after the end of the World War II. We didn't have any constitutional reform in the past 60 years, more than 60 years. And it's simply because it's so, so difficult to do a constitutional reform. Referendum, but that's one requirement. But the most important requirement is two-thirds of the members of both houses must support the reform. So this is so unlikely. So this is a difficult solution, ideal maybe, but it's so difficult. The second solution is to do electoral reform. The Marxists says this: electoral rules should be harmonized so that any government coalition would be likely to control both chambers. An interesting feature that I often highlight when I talk about Japanese electoral reform in 1994 is that the electoral reform was just the reform of the lower house elections, electoral systems. And I have a paper published in American Journal of Political Science, and we showed that there was a significant reapportionment of seats in 1994, and that changed the budget allocation. So malapportionment was seat was severe problem under the 1955 system, but thanks to this electoral reform in 1994, more seats are now allocated in urban areas. So given this, after the introduction of new electoral system, the ruling party, LDP, particularly Koizumi, tried to to introduce so many policies and so many reforms which are in favor of urban voters. But the upper house electoral system, we only had a minor change in the upper house electoral system, and we still have massive malapportionment of seats, so many seats in the rural areas. So LDP is now facing inconsistent incentives. On the one hand, to gain a majority of seats, they have to please urban voters, but on the other hand, in the upper house elections, they need to get support from rural voters. So this inconsistency must be solved. That's one argument. But that's actually what Mike said, but is it really desirable to have the same party coalition controlling both chambers? Okay. That's the question I had after day one. Actually, that's a question and ideas I got by attending day one session. Okay, so then I had a chat with some people and also attended today's sessions. And then I began to think that there may be another solution, which doesn't require constitutional reform, which doesn't require any electoral reform. Okay. Simply, the major parties, LDP and DPJ in particular, they should discuss. And then discuss what? Discuss informal intercameral procedures for conflict resolution. They should learn from other experiences in other countries. They should discuss. They don't discuss. They just fight. Because they haven't faced these situations. And the DPJ just wants to get, a power. But they need to discuss, and it's, I think, mutually beneficial in the long run. And, of course, I can suggest this, but maybe they don't listen to me. But this is perhaps a reasonable solution that they have to seriously think, because electoral reform is difficult, and a constitutional reform is almost impossible. Now, so I said they came to Australia and they learned something. So I think they learned from Australian experience, and then I hope they know how to compromise. Okay. But anyway, conclusion. Retrospectively expected, I want to say something more theoretical. The electoral reform 1994 lower house was aimed. Well, so many reasons, but the main reason was to introduce effective two-party system, okay? Like US, like UK. That's what so many people said. Okay, the legislative deadlock was expected, given no change in the upper house electoral reform and no change in the Japanese constitutions, simply because two-party system, as I said, two-party system plus strong bicameralism is equal to political stagnation, deadlock. Okay. Comparatively exceptional, this is my question, I want to study more, and I want to discuss with you more in the future. Is Japan's bicameralism exceptionally strong? Okay. But more theoretically, it may be worth thinking, what is the optimal strength of the second chamber in parliamentarism? Thank you very much.
Two wonderful presentations to round us out. Campbell Sharman, stand by.
Campbell Sharman, first a clarification. I didn't say that majoritarian parties were necessarily inconsistent. Mm. I said that people who have a strongly majoritarian view of politics don't like bicameralism. Okay. Now, you've turned your machine off. That's a shame.
Okay.
can you go back to your slide, Australia, Japan?
Where is it?
Third last one, maybe.
Oh, here?
Yes. Yeah, okay. No, it's gone. Okay, well, yeah. got to be there somewhere. Okay. The dissolution. Please note, the Governor General cannot dissolve both houses just because they disagree. Okay. So, for example, in 1975, you could only dissolve the upper house because they had a stack of bills ready to that they'd knock back. But just by itself, no. Okay. But that reminds me, Western Australia had a situation like that, where the upper house could not be dissolved. Okay. Oh. And I think at times it's been possible in some other state upper houses, and South Australia too. But the what you didn't mention is that if there is a deadlock, nothing happens. Okay? Now, that's a perfectly satisfactory outcome. Okay? Mr. Whitlam, I haven't got a fixed idea about 1975, but it's a good example. Mr. Whitlam said, in no other system can the upper house stop a budget. Well, the answer is nonsense. The US regularly has periods where the budget is left hanging, and what happens is people get more and more frustrated, and particularly the people in the two houses get more and more upset about what the public would think, and eventually they come to a compromise. So that nothing is a perfectly satisfactory outcome. It's not a problem.
Thank you, Cam.
Yeah. Stan? Then Meg? Then John.
Two very interesting and informative presentations. I thank you both. I have to admit, though, that I'm so taken with the notion of a twisted parliament that I'd like to ask a question about Japan. As I understand it, if in the forthcoming election the LDP coalition's majority in the lower house falls below 2/3, then the opposition majority in the upper house can effectively block any legislation except the budget.
Yes.
Is there a constitutional definition or even a statutory definition of that defines the budget bill?
Budget-related bills?
Not the budget-related bills, bill itself.
The budget, yes.
In other words, mm-hmm. would it be possible to tack on other legislation onto the budget bill?
That's not possible.
And what would prevent that?
Because there is a clear definition of the budget.
Pardon?
The clear definition of the budget stated in the Japanese Constitution.
It defines would constitute the budget bill?
Yeah.
Okay, so you couldn't use that.
That's not possible.
Okay. Mm. I'm trying to think what options might be available, because I think I differ with Sharman to this extent.
Mm.
Doing nothing is acceptable in that it leaves the status quo in place, but as a matter of policy, it may not be an acceptable status quo. Mm.
Thanks, Dan. Meg, and then John Owens.
Mm. I'd like to come back to a similar point that I raised with the previous panel, which is about legitimacy in this situation. Mm. Sorry, I should preface my remarks by saying two fantastic papers. Thank you very much. Fascinating. But my question is about Japan. To come back to this point of legitimacy, and where's the public in all this? Where's public opinion in all this? Mm. And I'd be inclined to think don't panic in your situation, because if your nightmare scenario comes and say the LDP gets 60% of the vote, but the opposition has a majority in the upper house, then what would public opinion be then about the opposition continually blocking everything? Mm. I think if that happened in Australia, the public would not take kindly to that and would condemn and punish the opposition parties. I think that's what they do in the UK. And therefore, I think in that situation, it might be that the opposition parties simply have to start compromising, particularly if the LDP is clever and proposes popular legislation, which has public backing.
Mm.
So maybe there's not so much to panic about, and it's just a cultural change that you need to go through to get to a point where there's more of a culture of compromise.
Very, very, very interesting point, and I need to think about it more carefully. But my major area of research is political economy, comparative politics, electoral institutions. But another field I have been working on is public opinion, and I have done some analysis of the Japanese public opinion, and in the past 50 years. But there's an interesting development in the opinion results. Since the early 1990s, since the LDP lost a majority of seats in the upper house, and then since we had so many political scandals, political conflicts, the percentage of people saying that I'm not interested in Japanese politics is going up like this. Okay. And the percentage of Japanese people saying that I don't have any party that I want to vote for is also going up like this. Currently, if you ask a question, if there's an election, lower house election, tomorrow, which party do you vote for? Okay, and the largest percentage, more than 6%, is no party. I don't vote. Turnout is in the lower house 50 to 60. We don't have a compulsory voting system. No. But depending on the media coverage, those floating voters may vote. And depending on the political mood, they vote for LDP. That happened in 2005. But the same voters voted for the DPJ in 2007. The public opinion has become so unstable and so unpredictable. But I'm not sure what I'm answering to your question. But given this, the political parties and party leaders cannot effectively use public opinion to legitimize what they wanted to do.
Thank you, John. We're within 5 minutes of closing, so.
All right. John, I mean, it's really a question to both of you about intercameral relations. In the first case, Asher, I need to know more about the structure of the party. This also applies to the second paper as well. To what extent is there collusion and coordination between the respective leaders of the different chambers? How often is there conflict and how often is there cooperation? You mentioned one particular instance over the anti-terrorism legislation where the second chamber was required to concede. How typical of that? I mean, is it just a rare example? So under normal circumstances, when there is a unified party control of both chambers, then you get a lot of cooperation and coordination between the two chambers. And then I guess the question for the Japan paper is almost the opposite. And it goes to Meg's question. I need a definition of stalemate, and I'm curious as to why it can't be resolved. Why aren't the mechanisms in place to implement some kind of compromise between the two institutions? Why are they just throwing their hands up or throwing their toys out of the pram and just abandoning compromise? Now, is this... Meg mentioned public opinion, that pressure of public opinion, or is this something to do with the factional structure of Japanese parties? I need the explanation here as to why this is happening.
I'm glad we've got email. Yes.
Do you want to go first?
That's one part actually I glossed over. I sort of given a kind of a background of how, you know, of the party structure as it operates at the federal level. You know, right up to from 1952, which is when the first general elections in India were held, up to 1975, there was no problem in the intercameral, you know, coordination, chiefly because the Congress was in power, you know, uninterrupted from 52 to 1975. 75 is the year when Indira Gandhi, you know, proclaims emergency for 2 years.
Which chamber is going first in processing a piece of legislation?
Oh, it can be constitutionally. Any house can initiate a bill. You know, either the Lok Sabha or the Rajya Sabha. Well, the ruling party usually has a parliamentary party situated in both the houses, and they can initiate from any of the houses. Usually, they do it; they steer it from the lower house, but it can also come from the upper house. So it can also come from the upper house. So what I'm trying to say is, from 52 to 75, there was no problem, or there was no areas of friction between the two houses. Frictions began right after the emergency was lifted and general elections were held. The Janata Party came to power, you know, and the Congress under Indira Gandhi was still in a majority in the Rajya Sabha. So what the Janata Dal came, Morarji Desai, when he became the Prime Minister, what he wanted to do was to undo what Indira Gandhi had done during the emergency of trying to, scrap all those constitutional amendments that Indira Gandhi had introduced, but they could not be successful. They could, because the constitutional amendment requires a 2/3 members present in voting in both the houses, so they had to, compromise with the Congress and pass some of the amendments of the previous amendments. I'm re-amending the amendments. But with the rest, they had to concede to the Congress majority in the Rajya Sabha. So that was the first instance of friction. After 77, the Janata Party was in power from 77 to 80. From 80 again till almost until 93, again the Congress comes back in power. But this is also a time when regional parties start getting elected to the Rajya Sabha. And so there is a multi-party system is being created. And after, and then there is this, not exactly a two-party system, but a two large coalitional formations, under the NDA, under the BJP and the Congress, and the Congress front called the United Progressive Alliance, UPA government. So there is a kind of a seesaw battle between them in both the houses. But if any of these have a majority in both the houses, there are no areas of friction. But it has happened in the past twice. The joint sittings have been held only thrice in the history of the Indian Parliament. But there have been bills that have been passed from this house and have been rejected, and there has been a stalemate, and nobody cares. So it's allowed to die. Some of those bills are allowed to die. But if the party can then engineer some sort of support from the independents or the smaller parties and can drum up its majority in the upper house, then they push through a bill.
I have two answers to your question, but relating to that, I need to say just one thing to the question from Campbell. You said that a bill being abundant is not so problematic. Under certain circumstances, that may be true, but in the case of Japan, if LDP coalition will not be able to get 2,000 seats in the lower house in the next election, most likely the DPJ coalition in the upper house will reject almost all legislations. So complete deadlock may happen, which I think is so problematic. Then go back to your question. Then why DPJ and LDP cannot cooperate with one another? Why they cannot compromise? Two answers. One is front benches. We don't say front benches, but the powerful politicians in the opposition coalition were former LDP politicians. They left in 1993 to form the new non-LDP government. That's the single most important goal for them. And they competed with other LDP politicians under SNTV, maritime member district system, which encouraged intra-party competition. To answer to the question two, which of course is related to question, the answer number one, is I said to Meg that Japanese public opinion is becoming more unpredictable and unstable, and politicians are not paying attention to public opinion. But after listening to your question, I changed my mind. Actually, the DPJ may be carefully watching the public opinion, but just one question asked in several different surveys. That is, do you support the major government change? And the percentage of Japanese people who support the new non-LDP government after the next lower house election is going up. So the media criticizes the strategy taken by DPJ so much, almost every day. But still, the single most important to achieve the single most important goal, which is to have the non-LDP government, the DPJ has no interest in making a compromise with LDP.
Thank you. Some of you were here dawn yesterday. Many of you are here dawn today. Some of you may have a determination to be here dawn tomorrow and the day after. I'm not going to stand in your way. But we're going to get out of here. There are a series of cabs booked to take some of the people back to University House, and I have to honour that. Before I invite you to thank our last panel, which really was an inspiration to have both of you here with really rich, detailed case studies, which I really enjoyed. Remember where we started, to gather together, try and listen a bit to internal experiences and then to broaden that to comparison so that we could try and put Australia into a larger context. Why did we want to do that? Well, our aim is to get a book out, and I think for those of you who have been locked in here for the last 2 days know that we've got a book within the room in the discussion, whether it's one volume or two. Maybe bicameralism means we're committed to two volumes, I don't know, but there's a lot of rich material here, and that's wonderful. I have to thank the two clerks, the clerk of the Senate in particular, Harry Evans, but also the clerk of the House of Representatives. Got to thank the Australian Research Council. They succumbed to a plea from the two clerks and myself to establish some funding for the Parliamentary Study Centre, and that funding has been the core of the funding that's gone into this program. I've got to thank the Senate staff in particular, David Sullivan. Kay and Gillian have been here working for this program, not just over the last couple of days, but several months going back. The chairs from today, coming from the Senate, Rosemary and Maureen. My ANU colleagues, particularly Rachel McGrath-Kerr, who's at the back of the room, who's the administrator for the Parliamentary Studies Centre. Rachel, are you able to stand and wave? Yes. I'll get you a volume of the complete standing orders of both houses signed by both clerks as a gift. If you've got a young child that doesn't sleep, well, this will stop that. Phil Larkin, my colleague who helps run the Parliamentary Studies Centre, who's over on the corner. Phil was working now in the Senate, about to take up a new distinguished position at the University of Canberra. That's wonderful. Scott Brenton, my ANU colleague, who's been patiently paying attention, not getting in the way, but forming his own judgments, and will be writing up a report on this conference, which will appear on the Parliamentary Studies website. That's wonderful. Helen Moore, who's in the room as well, who's helped me on this and other centre projects. The Crawford School, the banner will be rolled down soon and taken back to the Crawford School, and they've helped us. The speakers, of course. We have to thank the people who've come from their busy professional lives, stopped what they're doing in other parts of the world or other parts of Australia or other parts of this building in order to be in here for some part of 2 days, and that's wonderful. The administrators and officials who don't normally have a talking role in running parliaments but have a doing role, to get them to talk about that doing role is wonderful. The academics who've been involved with the Parliamentary Studies Centre, Meg and Stan in particular, who are part of the International Advisory Board, taking a larger load than some of the others, and I'm really indebted to the two of you for doing that. And the audience, the people who've mysteriously stayed for 2 days. You've got to get a life. I'm going to help you get a life very soon. So that's it. There's no more tea, there's no more coffee, there are no more biscuits, there are no more sandwiches. If you want a twisted diet over the weekend, go chase it yourself. Thank you. Oh, and thank the final panel. That was great. I really enjoyed it.